to have got the chance to get Teasel, Dr. Muir Harmony, along to talk about her new book, Operation Moonglow, which I believe in the UK is being published by Hachette. Is that right, Teasel? Yeah, fantastic.
Yes,
I'll just send a quick link in the chat there. So, I'll just send that in a second. But yeah, thank you very much for joining us today. So how this is going to work is we're going to be talking to Dr. Teasel Muir Harmony from the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., about a recently published book, Operation Moonglow, A Political History of Project Apollo. So I'll ask a few questions to start off with. So during that time, to the audience, if you kind of think of any questions that you want to ask, if you put those in the chat, I'll be able to see those and then I'll pose them to Teasel. So yeah, get thinking of questions. But Teasel, thank you very much for joining us today and for sharing your work with us. I think it's a really fantastic book. There are obviously hundreds of books that have been published about Apollo. But I think one of the brilliant things that this book does is that it tells Apollo as a diplomatic story, and it puts diplomacy not as something that's a kind of spin-off or an afterthought or a kind of curiosity, but it puts diplomacy and the day-to-day business of diplomacy, how diplomacy is carried out, really at the heart of this story, which I think tells a story that might be familiar to many people in a wholly new light. So just to sort of start off, I was wondering, what was the relationship between the American space program and between US diplomacy?
It's a very, very important relationship, fundamental to the shape of the American space program and the types of programs that were invested in initially. I think it might be worthwhile saying that space diplomacy, or the relationship between the American space program and diplomacy, sort of maps a lot onto science diplomacy more generally. So there are a number of areas that are important to mention. So the role of space in national security and military space, and then diplomacy in support of international cooperation in space science and things like that. And then there's also this other element, which is space for diplomacy. And I think that'll be the topic we focus on today, but that was an important part of why space became a major national priority during the Kennedy administration, why the United States invested incredible resources in sending humans to the moon. But this sort of idea that space exploration and human spaceflight in particular could serve U.S. international relations interests to support U.S. diplomacy and even more broadly, the United States' relationship to the world. So from everything from building alliances to influencing culture and values and demonstrating the values of a liberal democracy in opposition to communism or socialism. So it was part of a much larger project, but this idea of space for diplomacy is really, really important to sort of the shape of the space program, what we ended up prioritizing within the United States.
Fantastic. So thinking about kind of space for diplomacy, if space is being used to kind of transmit a message to sort of various audiences around the world, who is that audience and what is the message that the United States is trying to transmit with these incredibly sort of inspiring, very expensive space spectaculars?
So that message, it changed over time, over the course from the 1950s through the 1960s and to the 1970s. But overall, it was tied to this idea that, especially starting in the 1950s, but this particular context of the Cold War, the existence of nuclear weapons, the importance of international publics to politics in that day, the role of media in particular, sort of the media revolution, all these factors contributed to the important significance of public opinion and general public. And so with the United States space program and also the Soviet space program, there was a lot of sort of targeted effort to win over the hearts and minds of the world public. That was a big part of the audience that these space spectaculars were aimed at, and a lot of the associated public relations programming. But there was also an expectation that it would be important in influencing the hearts and minds of world leaders as well. So it was sort of multiple audiences, and it played out in various ways. But the idea was that these large space spectaculars, like sending humans to the moon, would convince people that for lunar exploration, that the greatness of American society, the capacity, the industrial output of the United States, a demonstration of American values more generally, which was really important at this moment when scientific and technological programs and were seen as sort of important factors in progress more generally. So all of this is sort of in the mix. But the audiences were basically global in scale, and a lot of it's also tied to this important context of the Cold War, where you have many newly independent nations, and there was an expectation both within the United States and the Soviet Union that these space spectaculars, these demonstrations of space capability, would be important for influencing the social and political trajectory of these new nations.
Thank you. So just to sort of pick up on something there, you know, kind of the idea of a space spectacular orbiting humans around the Earth or landing them on the moon, orbiting them around the moon, it's kind of easy to see how that might demonstrate your scientific and technical prowess. You know, it's a very impressive feat. But how can you use these sort of, I guess, demonstrations to broadcast values? And particularly, how can you use them to broadcast specifically American values? Or how did the Kennedy and Johnson administrations use them?
So it was done, and it's worth saying that for the United States, the U.S. Information Agency and the State Department worked closely together to promote the American space program abroad. NASA worked on domestic public relations, but sort of large-scale global public relations capacity of the USIA and State Department really supported and amplified the achievements by working with local press, by showing films, helping create films on space missions, working with local television, radio, the Voice of America, so exhibits, all sorts of things. So this was part of the effort to amplify this message, and they worked really carefully on crafting particular rhetoric and promoting certain images of the American space program. And those were done sort of in response to the ways that audiences abroad reacted to the messaging. And so initially, the United States really promoted spaceflight, you know, tried to cultivate an audience interested in it, and then looked to see what would work. So initially, there was a greater emphasis on technological capability, this idea that we had to demonstrate the sort of technical capacity of the country. And then that shifted over time. So from a demonstration of U.S. might to messages about inclusiveness and this idea that space exploration was for all humankind. But the messaging, the sort of the framing of the meaning and significance of spaceflight and the meaning and significance of spaceflight, not just for the United States, but what it means to the world more generally, was seen as really essential. So a lot of work went into sort of fine tuning that messaging and changing it over time to make sure it was as impactful as it could be, and it sort of had as much political potency as possible.
Thank you. One of the really great things I think about this book is that it doesn't just tell you a kind of political history of how the Apollo program itself takes form and the sort of forces that it responds to, but it also tells you how this audience that you talk about was created and solicited, and how people are brought into this kind of community of people who watch and are involved in spaceflight. And I think that's one of the great things that this book does, is just it shows the kind of sheer amount of effort that had to be put in to create this global audience for space spectaculars. So I'll open the floor open for questions now. I've got a couple that someone has emailed in beforehand, but if anyone has any questions, just pop them in the chat on the side, and then I'll ask them to Dr. Mia Harmony. So the first questions, well, these are kind of two questions from Ross. And Ross asks, do you think there's a capacity to explain the Apollo program in terms of American empire, or is this an imperial venture? So that's his sort of first question. And then the second question is, what's the sort of relationship between technology and ideology when it comes to America's sort of space effort? So two quite big questions there. So the first about, is this an imperial venture? And the second, what's the relationship between technology and ideology within the United States?
Sure. So I think when talking about relationship of something like the Apollo program to empire, to think of it in terms of sort of this empire by invitation and or informal empire. There was this expectation that sending humans to the moon, returning them safely back to Earth, this objective that Kennedy set out in 1961, what this would do, it would win the hearts and minds of the world public. But not only that, and Kennedy's really explicit when he proposes Project Apollo in 61, and he says that it would influence the minds of people who are attempting to make a determination of which road they should take. So whether or not they should pursue liberal democracy, or whether or not socialism or communism, and which country they would align with. And the expectation is that Apollo was going to be essential to making the world friendly to U.S. interests. And whether or not you want to talk about that as empire, it's a bit hairy, but the sort of fundamental to the objective and expectation of Project Apollo was that it would influence the societies and the culture and the politics of other countries, and in a way that would make it easier for the United States internationally in various ways. But basically to serve US global interests, and those are somewhat more informal at times than a traditional empire, but the idea was that it would make the world more friendly to the United States. But then also I think really importantly, to make the world more like the United States as well. So the idea was that, you make people around the world feel like participants in this American-led endeavor. And in some ways this creates an American global community. So that's an important fundamental part of Project Apollo, and why President Kennedy really prioritized Apollo. And I think it's worth mentioning, especially to a audience that's probably more focused on the Cold War and international history than space history in particular, that Project Apollo was the largest civilian technological program in U.S. history, and it was over 4% of the federal budget by the mid-1960s. It employed a workforce of hundreds of thousands of people. By the mid-1960s, that was over 400,000 people across the United States and across the world. And today, the whole lunar exploration initiative in the United States would be equivalent to about $280 billion. So it was really, really massive in scale. And for Kennedy, it was one of the major national priorities. I think it says a lot about the Kennedy administration and how much the administration valued soft power and this sort of expectation that they needed to pursue a type of program that would win the hearts and minds of the world public, but then also foster greater international alignment.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, again, this is the thing that the book does really well, is this creation, as you call it in the conclusion, of the imagined community, after Benedict Anderson, of this global interconnected world. And I guess a world that looks quite American in a way in terms of its values. So I've got a question here from Jeffrey Horn, who says, I believe the US military was initially very involved in the space program, but the US shifted the space program to a very pacifist message. We came in peace for all mankind. Was this due to a decision in the direction of policy, or was it due to technological and financial limitations?
So part of the shift in the messaging and the emphasis was on sort of an evaluation of what would support U.S. foreign relations interests and American power more generally. And so when the United States established NASA in 1958, there was a conscientious decision to separate civilian and military space. And that was quite important. And so often when we talk about the American space program, we focus on civilian space. And that was that's a result of this really intentional decision to separate civilian and military space so that the United States could be very, very open about its civilian space program. And a lot of people, they don't forget, but, you know, we don't really talk about the sort of military space in the United States nearly as much. And what this allowed for is it allowed for this strong messaging about the peaceful intentions of the American space program. It allowed the United States to be very open about its space program and the hardware of its space program. So the United States started sending spacecraft abroad. They would share diagrams. Lots of scientists and engineers, and then later astronauts, would travel the world sharing information about the American space program and certain missions. And the idea was that it was focused on science and engineering. This would be more objective. And this was also a demonstration of an open democratic society. And it was really tied to this decision to split apart civilian and military space so that you could have this message about the peaceful intentions of the United States. Now, people were always aware that there was close correlation with the development of missiles and ICBMs and lift capacity and those implications for national security. But within the United States, it was seen as really effective to sort of lean into science, messaging about science, the apolitical nature of science, that the United States was for the benefit of all humankind, because that was seen as serving the sort of larger political interests of the country.
Yeah, I think wonderful that the fact that we sort of associate the US space program just with kind of NASA rather than perhaps, you know, sort of the Department of Defense and other organizations, the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office. Yeah, I think shows that this is an incredibly powerful sales pitch. It's one that really kind of grabs the attention of the world. So I've got a question here from Kendrick Oliver. Hello, Kendrick. A familiar name. He asks a question that he says is obvious, but still bears thinking about. Why the PR focus on crewed space flights rather than forms of space activity that might spread the benefits of space flight more broadly? So satellites, et cetera. Why focus on, you know, the space activities involving crewed missions in the PR offensive?
So in early evaluations, it was seen as more impactful, and I think it's NASA Administrator James Webb that said it's men and not merely machines that capture the imagination. And there was this belief that human space exploration was going to be more impactful, more exciting, had more potential to capture the imaginations of the world public. And Kennedy was wary at first of investing too much in human space flight, and his science advisor, who needed an early evaluation of the American space program during the presidential transition, really cautioned against it. Human spaceflight is much more costly. It's more risky. And it was even advised, maybe you should even reconsider sending humans into space at all. And we should be looking into other types of programs that have more direct uses on Earth. And even after Yuri Gagarin's flight, which was really impactful to Kennedy's decision-making about space, Kennedy initially thought maybe we should pursue the desalination of water or something like that. We need to pursue some type of large-scale, impressive scientific and technological program, but, you know, maybe something else. But it became very, very clear that it had to be spaceflight. And then it became clear it had to be human spaceflight in particular. So it was something that was determined at that time as more impactful. And I will say that there is some sort of legacy of that today. And I remember after the end of the shuttle program, I would hear a lot of people say that NASA was canceled. And I always found that really funny, because NASA is an agency that's had a relatively stable a level of funding from the 1970s, about half a percent of the federal budget. Since that time, the 60s was a big boon, but after that, it's been relatively stable. And there are many branches of NASA. So, you know, you have planetary exploration and astrophysics and heliophysics and earth sciences, or all these other sort of robust areas of research. And because of the shuttle program had been canceled, people thought that NASA in general had just, you know, closed up shop. And I think that says a lot about how important human spaceflight has been for public attention, at least up to this point. I don't know if it will continue to be so, but at least for many decades, it has been sort of the most publicized and the most visible part of the space program.
Thank you. I've got another question here from Jeffrey. If anyone has any questions, please put them in the chat. Got plenty of time. And I think kind of this idea of Apollo, US history, Cold War history, diplomacy, anything you want to ask. So Jeffrey asks a question considering the context of the time with the Vietnam War. Do you think that Apollo's messaging was heavily diluted or blunted by those events which were happening in parallel? To quote the song, Denny kicked a landmine the day mankind kicked the moon. I'm afraid I don't know the song. So how do we sort of square this with the Vietnam War? And does the Vietnam War sort of rob perhaps this message of global interconnectedness of its power?
The relationship between Apollo and Vietnam is really fascinating. There's so much to say about it. I think that it did really undermine the messaging about U.S. interest in peace and humankind, and that it was interested in sort of larger peaceful global community. So a lot of the messaging around Apollo was, you know, if you go into outer space, you look down on Earth and you don't see any political boundaries, and you recognize that we're part of a global community, and you recognize the need for peace and cooperation. And this is a big part of the messaging. And then you have the Vietnam War, and it really did undermine that messaging. But I will say in a similar way, U.S. civil rights struggles also really undermined that messaging, especially in the mid-1960s. And public diplomats would, foreign affairs officers would write back to the State Department and USIA saying, there's only so much we can do. People do like spaceflight. They enjoy these stories. But, you know, when we have these civil rights injustices happening in the United States, or with the Vietnam War, when we have news about that, people really question whether or not, even if they like this part of the United States, whether or not the U.S. is actually a good model society. And that was often the way it was spoken about, is like, is this going to demonstrate that the United States is a model society? And with civil rights, it was like, we can't sort of paint over or chrome over some of this sort of rottenness of American society. We have to fix it as well. And space can only do so much. And with the Vietnam War, there was another, I think, important relationship is sort of more practical, but there was a lot of enthusiasm about how the Apollo program, the first lunar landing, displaced headlines in newspapers about the Vietnam War. And that enough was seen as important politically for the United States. And so just to give people a sort of a rest, or like shift their attention away from the Vietnam War, was seen as really beneficial. And that's sort of a smaller scale accomplishment or impact, but it's worth noting. I think one thing, and just because we're talking about Vietnam, one thing I like to mention is that the Apollo program at the time cost about $25 billion. And that by the late 1960s, that was how much the United States was spending per year in Vietnam. And there are many similarities between Apollo and the Vietnam War in that they were both part of this larger foreign relations initiative to address the idea that communism and the Soviet Union were expansionist forces, and that the United States had to contain communism as much as possible, and this fear of other countries becoming aligned with the Soviet Union as opposed to the United States. And Apollo is a great demonstration of a soft power approach to addressing that concern. And I think Vietnam is clearly a demonstration of hard power, coercive force. And so there's a lot to be said about those, you know, those two large scale U.S. National security related initiatives.
A great thing I think in the book is weaving those two stories together, because in space history, you might get kind of, The odd mention, perhaps, oh, by the way, Vietnam was going on at this time as well. And then equally, in sort of your standard histories, the 60s, there'll be a paragraph on the moon landings. And then, you know, we return to the sort of these domestic or international stories. I've got a question here from Sarah, who's one of my HY245 students on my US and the World course. Hello, Sarah. And she asks, I was wondering, could we consider the US space program as part of Kennedy's push for modernization theory abroad, and especially in the Third World? Did he want to use American scientific expertise as a tool to build US prestige in order to spread American values against communism?
I would say yes, exactly. that is an important part of this. Modernization theory was really, and Rostow in particular, impactful to Kennedy. And this larger moment, this idea that science and technologies were drivers of progress, and the United States could demonstrate its own approach to modernity and modernization through the American space program. And I think the Soviet Union was doing a similar type of thing at the time. But in addition to more of the public relations campaign related to spaceflight, there was also a lot of interest in space cooperation and pursuing projects of international scientific cooperation with countries around the world, helping them to participate in spaceflight, especially if they didn't have launch capabilities. And so I think it was summed up really well in that question. I think it is a central to why Kennedy and other presidents like Johnson decided to support and promote American spaceflight. I will say also, for someone like Johnson, he saw the American space program, he called it the launch pad for a great society. And he saw that he thought the NASA centers in the American South were going to be also important for the development of the American South. So it wasn't just this idea that space exploration would help for the development of the rest of the world, but then also within the United States as well. And I could add that a lot of the exhibits and things like that, for the idea was that, you know, you're going to bring American science and technology to populations around the world. And they really targeted students, especially students in STEM, and created special programs and things like that as a way to, you know, share American science and technology, which was both universal and objective, but yet also had this was American in style too. This is a sort of a funny combination of things.
Yeah, I think that kind of idea of universality, but a very American universality, is is really fascinating thread that runs through the book. A bit of an update, if anyone is creating a kind of Apollo playlist at the moment, the song that Jeffrey was referring to was "I Was Only 19" by Redgum. So you can add that to Whitey on the Moon, various other kind of Apollo songs. Michael Reynolds asks, so would Apollo have been possible without the inspiration and encouragement that Kennedy injected into the debate? So what's the role of kind of Kennedy within the origins of Apollo?
It's tricky. I think a lot of credit has to be given to both Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. And I think sometimes we give too much credit to Kennedy. It's worth noting that Kennedy wasn't a space enthusiast. He didn't follow the space program very carefully when he was in the Senate. He was concerned with foreign relations. He used the missile gap as a way to critique the Eisenhower administration. But he was concerned with foreign relations and newly independent nations and trying to figure out what the United States should do. He got to the objective of supporting sending humans to the moon and landing them safely back on Earth because he thought this was going to be necessary within this global Cold War. And this was going to be necessary for winning alignment and winning hearts and minds and sort of shaping the trajectory of the other nations. He supported Apollo in as much as he thought that it would serve those particular foreign relations objectives. He wasn't that inspired by exploration or science. That's not why he invested in spaceflight. He says as much. He even reached out to Khrushchev twice to see if the United States and the Soviet Union could travel to the moon jointly, because for him it was politics and As Jerome Wiesner, his science advisor, said, I don't know if I mentioned this, but it was technology for politics. And that's how it was viewed. But Lyndon Johnson was really essential for sort of guiding the sort of space objective. He was really critical to the establishment of NASA in response to Sputnik back in the 1950s. And then Kennedy asked Johnson, you know, find me a space program that promises dramatic results that we can win. And so he made the stakes really clear. So he wanted promises dramatic results. And Johnson worked really, really hard, meeting with people, put intense effort into coming up with the objective. But not only that, and I think this is important to note, Johnson met with members of Congress to ensure that there would be bipartisan support of a lunar objective. And having that bipartisan congressional support was really, really key. And then Johnson was also very, very key after Kennedy was assassinated to talking about Apollo as part of Kennedy's legacy, which basically ensured that it would get continued political support throughout the 1960s.
I know that the book is sort of more on the international ramifications and sort of feedback from Apollo, but I think one of the great achievements of it, almost you could say, is steering this mammoth project, as you say, the biggest civilian project in US history, through Congress and continually getting it renewed and it actually coming to fruition, because that's an incredible achievement, surely, that Johnson deserves a lot of credit for.
He does. And I think it's very, very important that he understood how Congress worked. He was the master of the Senate. He had that experience. And Kennedy made him head of the Space Council. And he was, during the Kennedy administration, somewhat sidelined. And so, but he put a lot of work into that. I think Johnson was an extraordinarily effective when it came to getting things done. And he thought space was important. He did talk about space flight and space exploration for many years as an important part of what American society should pursue and talked about it quite eloquently also during the first lunar landing, and especially in terms of diplomacy and bringing people together and pursuing sort of global unity in a peaceful manner.
Sure. So I've got another question from Kendrick here. As I say, please keep the questions coming. We've still got time for plenty more questions. This is quite an interesting one. Kendrick asks, the space slump of the early 1970s can be overstated. So to the non-space historians in the room, this sort of, I guess, public disenchantment with space exploration, the idea of space exploration no longer occupying this focal place in American culture and politics. So the space slump of the early 1970s can be overstated, but were there concerns amongst the officials that you've studied that space spectaculars were no longer working their magic after the landmark missions of Apollo 8 and Apollo 11? So what's the impact of the space slump then on the story you're telling?
Well, a lot of the people I study who worked in the State Department and the U.S. Information Agency at the White House, they were really sober when it came to the impact of the lunar landing on the U.S.'s position, on, you know, the popularity of the country or sort of how long that impact would last, and fully recognized that it would be limited and that it would go away over time, and that they had to really ensure that they had created programming to make it extend and last as much as possible. But they didn't expect that it was going to just change everything. There would be a revolution. It was interesting in the early 1960s in particular, there was a whole lot of talk about the potential sort of revolutionary implications of space exploration, and that it could change human existence and our ideas of ourselves, and that type of conversation continued through the 60s as well. But I think within government circles, there was a bit more pragmatic and the less expectation that, you know, we're going to send humans to the moon and all of a sudden there'll be world peace or something like that. And I don't think they thought that would happen. And they were really pleasantly surprised by the fact that more humans followed the first lunar landing than any event in history. They were aware that it was an American program, but they felt a sense of participation. And that was seen as, in some ways, the most I don't know, surprising, though, but notable feature in the evaluations of the Apollo program and of the lunar landing was that people around the world felt like participants in this American-led program, and that it had the type of impact that a global pandemic or a natural disaster might have in creating a sense of global unity, but it was almost like a global community brought about by an American program. And this was seen as really notable. They suggested it might even be a new form of politics. And but they knew that that interest and popularity would wane. And so that wasn't hugely surprising or much of a concern either. I will say that internationally, interest in the Apollo program was more sustained than within the United States, and the popularity of the American space program was greater abroad than it was within the United States. And domestically, Americans were quite critical of Apollo through the 1960s. And it was only around the first lunar landing in July of 1969 that more than half the American population thought Apollo was a good national investment. But for the rest of the 60s, a much greater percentage of Americans thought it was not a great national investment. And I think it's because of the limited implications for domestic politics and how it was really geared as a program to serve American diplomatic aims.
So we may be seeing a kind of reversal of this traditional narrative where we actually have quite a critical, cynical US public rather than, you know, sort of leave it to beaver style Americans who, golly, they love the space race. And then actually perhaps Apollo wins more people over.
There was also a fair amount of pride in the United States at the time, and perhaps even to this day, I think that there's a legacy of that kind of sense of, you know, national accomplishment that people like to point to. But there was a fair amount of critique, and especially when it came to national priorities and why are we sending humans to the moon when we can't, you know, feed people on Earth or house people or address the issues of real significance on the ground that we need to address.
Thank you. So I think this next question kind of leads on from that discussion of kind of national accomplishment and pride. It's from Alex Mayhew who asks, since much of this lay at the intersection of science and national identity, in what ways did the Apollo program embody Americanness? And how is this contrasted with the Soviet program and the Soviet Union more generally?
So it's sort of related to one of my answers earlier, and with the United States, this division between this civilian and military space. So one of the ways the space program was used to you know, demonstrate or to tell people internationally what America was, what American values were, was through the openness of the program. And so sharing scientific and engineering information was seen as a way to be open to demonstrate this interest in progress. The Soviet Union had a different approach where it was the space program. It wasn't divided between civilian and military, so it was much more difficult to share information, technical information. There are also a variety of reasons why they didn't want to initially, especially when it comes to the first human space flight. And the cosmonaut actually had to eject from the spacecraft and it crashed into the Earth. And there was concern that if you share technical information about that spacecraft, then that accomplishment would be called into question. And so there was very limited information available about the Soviet space program. They would announce accomplishments after they happened, whereas the United States was proactively inviting journalists to witness launches. And there was this messaging that we're open. This is a demonstration of an open democratic society. And so that was one of the important ways that the US sought to differentiate America from the Soviet Union through its approach to space programming. But I do think it's worth noting, because I do find this funny is probably not the right word, but both the Soviet Union and the United States tried to demonstrate sort of what was great about their societies and to differentiate, you know, each superpower through the same me through the same type of same type of program through Space Spectaculars. So it was sort of a sort of odd thing that the United States set out to differentiate itself from the Soviet Union by pursuing space exploration the same way that the Soviet Union was pursuing space exploration. You would think they maybe choose a different topic, but they both pursued space flight to differentiate each other from each other.
I think that's particularly apparent, you know, in the early kind of space moon race of the 1960s, where you have very similar missions following on from another. But one is this kind of demonstration, the superiority of the socialist system. And then, mm-hmm. you know, you have, oh, well, this is the same thing, essentially. You know, it's one guy orbiting around the Earth. But this actually demonstrates the efficacy of free markets and, you know, openness.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just ask, we've got another question from Jeffrey. But I'll just ask a very quick question. I mean, how much, because this was one thing I was quite interested in. We see in the early 60s, these really successful tours by Soviet cosmonauts around the world, where they're these huge celebrities, they're greeted rapturously, even if the country is quite anti-communist. Does the US kind of learn anything from the Soviet publicity tour? Or is it more that they sort of learn what not to do from the kind of cosmonaut tours? What do they learn from the experience of the cosmonauts going around the world?
So part of the response to the Soviet tours was this need to differentiate the American program and to demonstrate the difference of American values from the Soviet Union through the way the space program was presented internationally. And so initially, the United States decided to send hardware around the world, but kept the astronauts at home. And they said, what the Soviet Union is doing is propaganda, and we're not interested in propaganda. We will instead spend spacecraft. And that's not propaganda. That's an interest in sharing science. It's an interest in promoting interest in engineering, and so this is gonna differentiate these two countries. But then, by the mid 1960s, it was seen as beneficial to send astronauts abroad, and so the United States started doing that. But there was a greater emphasis on, you know, these astronauts are going to be sharing scientific and engineering information, so they're not. You know, they're not like the Soviet cosmonauts. They're not just, you know, this isn't just for propaganda and show. You know, when it came down to it, there was a limited difference, but there was a lot of discussion and thought put into, you know, how is what we're doing different than what the Soviet Union is doing, and how are our programs going to help people understand the differences between the United States, US values and Soviet values. And also the astronauts, just like a sort of a small detail there, the astronauts would wear civilian clothing, and often the cosmonauts would wear military uniforms. And in the United States, that was seen as another important symbolic demonstration that the United States program was peaceful and for all humankind, and that would communicate that to international audiences.
There's a phrase I really like in the book where you describe how, you know, the U.S., sends, or the Soviet Union sends cosmonauts, and they're just hailed as space heroes. But then one of your characters says, well, when we send them, they're space heroes and they're scientists. So is the idea we've won up the Soviets? I mean, you know, Yuri Gagarin looks great in his uniform, and people respond very well to him, but you know, he tends to be sort of not so great when he's talking about the scientific details of his flight. You know, he's better off, you know, talking about, I guess, these more heroic themes. So we've got a question here. This is more of a contemporary one. So considering the strong legacy that the US has from the Apollo program, do you think the American public will shrug off the loss of American dominance in space? Or could there be a sort of modern shock, like a manned Chinese landing on the moon, that would have an effect similar to Gagarin's flight and kind of galvanize a new interest and support in the space program?
Mm-hmm. I think that there is a decent chance that space accomplishments in other countries could galvanize the American space program, but I think it would be done in a very different way than we saw in 1961 with Gagarin's flight. And so often people refer to the space race, or maybe we need a new space race, or do we have a new space race? And they, I think, overlook the very particular context of the space race, and that it wasn't just the Soviet Union and the United States competing for each other you know, who's going to win. But it was really this larger global context. It was the very particular nature of the global Cold War, where you were trying to cross that finish line, not just to beat the Soviet Union, but for the entire audience that was watching you cross that finish line. And that moment where you have all these newly independent nations and the potential to affect the political systems of countries, or the idea that you might through something like space accomplishments, that was really essential to Kennedy's proposal of Project Apollo. That was fundamental to why the United States invested so heavily in spaceflight at the time. And it was also an important part of the Eisenhower administration's investment in space exploration. Prestige was seen from the very, very start as really important when it came to spaceflight, and this understanding that satellites and whoever was the first country to launch a satellite in space, there would be huge prestige benefits for that type of accomplishment. So that particular global Cold War context is really, really critical to the nature of the space race that we saw in the 1950s and the 1960s. And it's a very different world today than it was then. So even if, let's say, for instance, China sends humans to Mars or something like that, that might, just the announcement of that type of goal might kickstart, you know, a similar type of program within the United States, but it would be done in a very different way. I don't think it would be comparable. So it would probably play out in different ways. It'll be interesting to see, but it's a part of the conversation today. And I think it's so important to point back to that larger context of the 1960s when we talk about space race and a modern space race and what that might mean.
I think that's a really strong context that the book does respond to, is these undecided nations and reaching them. We've still got time for a couple of other questions. So if people have any, please do post those in the chat. But I was wondering about this kind of global audience. Is it the case that they're just these kind of passive observers? You know, they're an audience that maybe reacts to things, you know, whether that's sort of approvingly or disapproving, or do this sort of global audience, and particularly these decolonizing post-colonial countries, do they actually have any influence in sort of shaping the space age or the space race and how it's understood?
There are a few ways to answer that. One of the sort of dynamics that I like pointing to, which I think is very, very important, is in order for the United States to fulfill its global ambitions as the leader in the space race, it required having a global tracking network, which also then required the cooperation and buy-in of countries around the world. And so the importance of nations like Nigeria and Madagascar and Australia to the United States space program, and the need to win over the public and politicians within those countries so that the United States could have these tracking bases in these other locations. This is sort of an important part of that dynamic, and shows a lot of the sort of how the power dynamic was somewhat flipped in certain places for certain reasons. So I think that's an important part of that. It's a tricky question. I think it's also worth noting that there was a decision to do to perform a lot of symbolic activities on the moon, and a lot of that was impacted by the potential impact it would have on making the world feel like participants in the space program. But as far as some of the particular objectives when it came to human spaceflight, at least not so much initially. I'm trying to think, but I don't have a great answer for this question immediately, and I apologize.
I think still, you know, the points that you've raised about sort of that change in the message and how, you know, these symbolic activities are responding, because I think a great thing the book does is it shows from this initially very nationalistic sales pitch that is being made, you know, look at how wonderful our economic achievements are, which I feel, it, you know, is the kind of Soviet playbook to this incredible sales pitch about a global interconnected world. I think the book does an amazing job of showing how that is responding to the audience and they're, you know, sort of shaping that. And a thing that really struck me is that I've read Soviet propaganda from the late 1970s that is absolutely doing that Apollo theme. You know, that it's sort of rebounded and they're trying to kind of put a slight Soviet spin on it. But, you know, it's absolutely the theme that you describe. And it just made me think about those documents in a whole new light. We've still got time for a couple of other questions if people have them. So any final questions that that people have about, you know, sort of this public relations offensive, this propaganda, this diplomacy effort, or even the kind of legacies of Apollo, you know, sort of how we think about Apollo. But I thought that there was one kind of chapter that I found really interesting, which is the kind of chapter on Apollo 8. So not the moon landing itself, you know, this flight just before. And I was wondering if you could talk briefly about kind of Apollo 8. Does this see a real change in the messaging, or is this a particularly kind of effective moment of space diplomacy and space propaganda, I guess you could say?
With the Apollo 8, I see quite a significant shift. And so for those of you who aren't space historians or space enthusiasts, so this is the mission. It was the first time humans orbited the moon. And this was December of 1968. And a lot of the messaging around Apollo 8 was the idea that we live on one world. This is the mission where they took the Earthrise image. It became a very popular, iconic image, was disseminated around the world, published in newspapers. Archibald MacLeish wrote this wonderful sort of poem in the New York Times about how we're brothers, we're riders on this earth together. And a lot of the messaging there was about, you know, that we all live on one earth, and astronauts, you know, traveled all the way to the moon, and the most important thing they saw was the earth, and the most important thing they discovered was the earth. And so there was an awareness that this was this resonated with people. There was a Christmas Eve address. So the astronauts orbited the moon on Christmas Eve. They were told they were going to have the largest audience of more humans would hear their voices than had heard any human voice in history. You know, say something inappropriate was like quite an ask of them. And they read from Genesis. And the reason why Genesis was chosen was because it was seen to have it would be more universal, and it would connect to more people on Earth. And that was one of the decisions that was made to make this mission not just American or Christian. So some of the symbolism there. But a film was made about this mission and distributed around the world afterwards. And there's some great documents of this one in particular where Foreign Affairs officer was watching the audience watch the film. And this is something that they did. And they were observing the response to the film. And every time that the film really championed the United States, the audience would sort of roll their eyes and sigh. And it was just becoming very, very clear to everyone stationed around the world that people were aware that the Apollo program was an American program. We do not have to sell it that way. We can downplay it. And it's going to be much more effective when we do that. So Apollo 8 was an important part of that learning experience. And also the commander of Apollo 8, Frank Borman, Nixon sent him abroad to Europe because the mission was so popular. And Frank Borman just prompted incredibly large audiences and all these European cities when he traveled there. And interestingly, Nixon send Borman to these places just before he himself went to travel around Europe. So Nixon had just become president, and he thought it was going to be important to talk about how he wanted to shift U.S. foreign relations in particular, how he had a new agenda, how he was going to be seen as the peacemaker. And so he wanted to get that message out. And so he sent Borman to Europe to help pave the way and ensure that he would be more warmly received when he himself went on his tour.
Thank you. So I'm just going to put a link in here to the Hachette page for Operation Moonglow. Buy the book, please. It is a fantastic book. I highly recommend it. If there aren't any other questions, I might just ask a quick concluding question or a couple of questions. So the first is, as I've been raving about it before, I think it's a really fantastic book for describing, you know, the development of American space diplomacy and American space propaganda, the audiences it was trying to reach. But I was wondering, sort of, when you went into this project, you must have known kind of that, you know, this was a space propaganda and diplomacy push. So I was wondering what sort of surprised you from the research that you were doing. Was there anything kind of unexpected that you kind of found out from the archives? And then also, what's the kind of legacy of all of this? Because, you know, we don't live in a Cold War world anymore. You know, sort of, we haven't been to the moon in 50 years nearly as a human race. I'm using that very Apollo "we", so maybe that's a legacy. But humanity hasn't returned physically by sending people to the moon. So what's the legacy of all of this? But thank you.
All right. Well, to begin, I guess in the archives and doing this research, what impressed upon me the most was the role Apollo played in fostering a sense of global community, and that we all live on the Earth together, and that was the sort of sense of globalism or global interconnection was really closely tied to and driven by American national interests. And so when we talk about Apollo, remember Apollo, often people say, you know, global audience, Earth, you know, humankind did this. There's a lot of talk, but I think that some of the origins of where that sensibility came from or why there was a global audience gets taken for granted. And there's actually a lot of work and a lot of strategy and really tied to U.S. national interests that went into that sense of global connectedness. And I think that it is, Apollo is much more closely aligned to sort of the evolution and the process of globalization than I had realized. And that came through in the archives, especially when it comes to an increased awareness of global interconnection and where that awareness comes from and Apollo's role, and especially the USIA and the State Department's role in fostering that awareness of global community through an incredible circulation of icons, images like of Earthrise, to rhetoric and language like for all humankind, to shared experiences, the fact that people around the world watched the first lunar landing in unison, and creating the kind of communications infrastructure that was necessary for people internationally to follow that flight just in time. So I think it's an important part of that larger process. And that really came through the more time I spent in the archives and the more I realized how intentional this programming was. So I think that was quite important. And the second part of the question,
sorry about the kind of legacies, perhaps. What's left of Apollo now?
Yeah, what's left of Apollo? Well, a number of things is tricky. So at the Smithsonian, I'm the curator of the Apollo collection, and I was for the 50th anniversary of Apollo. And you know, 50th anniversaries are the perfect time, or a time where we talk about and we think back, you know, what's the legacy? What's the meaning of this program? And it has so many, so it's tricky for me to say, but I think it is more broadly, I think more broadly culturally, I think within the United States at least, there's this idea that grand things can be achieved when there's the right amount of investment. And there's this great story of that Kennedy told in his last speech about Project Apollo, that he referred to an Irish short story where there was kids going through a field and then they came to a wall they couldn't get over. And so they threw their hats over the wall because then they'd have to figure out a way to get over it. And so there's this mentality, this idea that, you know, grand challenges, you know, you set your mind to them, you, even if you don't know how you're going to do it, you can achieve it. And there's great value in that. And I think that the legacy of Apollo today is really tied to this idea that, you know, if you can land a man on the moon, you can do X, Y, and Z. And so there's still kind of a sense of optimism surrounding it and general enthusiasm. I've traveled quite a lot internationally and given talks about Project Apollo. And I'm always amazed with how much people know about the program and people share their own personal experiences with me. And it's quite marvelous to hear about all the different ways that Apollo has impacted people's lives in countries around the world. And so I think it was an important part of global history. And I hope it's increasingly remembered as part of global history and not just American history, because it really did. I think that's an important part of what Apollo was for and who Apollo impacted in the end.
Dr. Teasel Miyahami, thank you so much for joining us. I think it's been a fascinating conversation. And I think, yeah, really sort of demonstrating that this isn't just a story of technology. This isn't just a story of kind of Cold War rivalry. This is a much broader, much grander and deeper story with a lot of resonance today. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you everyone for joining us as well. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind giving a virtual round of applause, if you get those emojis going, that would be fantastic. We've got a couple of those already. Yeah, a thumbs up, a heart, fantastic. Yeah, various clapping emojis, wonderful. Yeah, so the book is available from Hachette. You can pick it up there. I would urge you to do that. But thank you once again for joining us, Teasel. And thank you to everyone for your questions.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. Take care, everyone. Goodbye.